Our mission has had the privilege of serving suffering Christians in Sudan since 1995. This map I designed to try and show the spiritual warfare in Africa in one vision, one visual. You see, the green areas are showing the 17 countries in Africa which are officially Islamic. 40% of the population of Africa are Muslims. Of course, most of them North Africa, but half of those are Arabs and the other half are black Muslims. The yellow areas represent where witchcraft or animism, African traditional religions, are the majority. The crosses, where over 20% of the population are evangelical Christians, the crescent moons, where over 20% are Muslims, and the skulls, where over 20% are animists. And then a red men, where there are wars. Very hard to keep up with that one. But you can see, we're talking about Sudan now, which was the largest country in Africa, but of course since independence in 2011 for South Sudan, no longer the largest country. Some of you will immediately remember this picture, the Pulitzer Prize winning photograph of 1994, taken by South African photojournalist Kevin Carter. This picture won the Pulitzer Prize, which is like the Academy Awards of Photojournalism. Kevin Carter, a South African, flew to New York and got his prize. After he got his prize, people start to ask him, what happened to the little girl in the picture? Well, I don't know, said Kevin Carter. Well, what's the story? How did you get the picture? He had flown in on his only time in Sudan. His aircraft was waiting on the landing strip. He only had an hour or two to get his photo ops, photographic opportunities. And while he was walking, he was only about 300 meters from the landing strip and the aircraft, and he saw this little girl, malnourished, too weak to stand, crawling, and then coming to a stop. He positioned himself in the shade of a tree, and he focused up, and he waited. Took light reading, and he said it took about an hour. But when that vulture hopped into the background, he said, I clicked the shutter, and I knew I had an award-winning picture. But what did you do after you took the picture? Well, I said to Kevin Carter, I sat under the tree and I smoked a cigarette. I cursed God and I smoked a cigarette. This little girl weighed less than his camera equipment. He could have carried her 300 yards to the aircraft. She could have got flown to Lokochopio in Kenya. Red Cross Hospital could have put her on a drip. She might have survived. He was blaming God for what he was personally responsible for. Kevin Carter, all he carried into Sudan was his cameras. All he carried out of Sudan was this picture. All he left behind in Sudan was cigarette stubs. When I look at this picture, I think of the words of the Lord Jesus, Matthew 25. Whatever you did not do unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you did not do it to me. Christians in Sudan have been under attack for centuries. Muslims smashing crosses, desecrating graveyards, burning churches. This was a beautiful woodland thatched Episcopal church bombed by MiGs, and some of the hot shrapnel hissed through the thatch and ignited it. And here's the pastor and his deacon standing in the ashes of what was once a beautiful wooden church. This church destroyed by helicopter gunships. And this one too. We've been there during the dry season when the bombings start bushfires and the dry bush just ignites and wild animals, domestic animals, farmlands, homes destroyed. Exterior decorating by Muhammad and Sons. Your home too can look like this. Phone 1-800-ISLAM. In Sudan, we have seen how many times the churches have the graveyards of the missionaries in front, like here, Fraser Cathedral, where the missionaries died and planted the seed in the ground. And a seed remains alone unless it dies and falls on the ground, then can produce 30, 40, 60, 100 fold. I've ministered about 1,200 times in Sudan. I've never ministered in any church that hasn't been bombed at least once, sometimes many times. This church bombed 10 times, destroyed 3 times, rebuilt each time. The church that will not die, Fraser Cathedral. I've ministered more in this congregation in Kotobi than any other. And this was destroyed by helicopter gunships just before we were running a Muslim evangelism workshop there. How many people do you know would walk several miles out of town carrying their own chair in heat, 30, 36 degrees Celsius, while there's a chance that helicopter gunships might attack you. When you come to the Transvaal, hospitality often is, here's the bathroom, here's the fridge, here's a towel. In Sudan, here's the bomb shelter, here's an AK-47, this is what you do if we're attacked. And that is true hospitality there, because amongst the swamps of the Sud, which can take 4 days to cross sometimes in some places, you see quite a few of the homes have got crosses on top. Many of the churches and buildings have got crosses on top. Some of the people are quite primitive, very much into animism. You'll see people who stretch their lips and stretch their ears and stretch their noses. There's still quite a few animists there. But many of the animists have been coming to Christ, and quite a few Muslims too. These are the Nuer people. When last did you read Genesis and Exodus? I can tell you the first time that people did in the Nuer language was 1995. We took in Genesis and Exodus the first time they had it in Nuer language, and up till then only had New Testaments. Flying into Sudan is quite a problem, because the UN at the time that we were trying to get were blocking and controlling the airstrips like Lokochokia, northern Sudan, into it and preventing us from getting in. Not only that, but the Sudan Air Force had at Juba and at Malakal Sudan Air Force bases, and they had a shoot on sight policy, you fly, you die, no flight service. So we had to find very adventurous missionary or mercenary pilots who are willing to fly for money behind the lines, and we managed to fly in many a time, over 70 different flights into Sudan over the years so far, delivering and distributing over 500,000 Bibles and Christian books so far by God's grace in about 26 different languages, libraries for schools, libraries for teacher training colleges, Bibles. Some of these pastors have 5, 10, 12 congregations to care for. Many times the Bible studies and services were held outside because the church building had been destroyed. The hunger for the gospel is intense. These people, you can see they, many of them were Episcopalians, have got the Anglican form of formal dress that had liturgies, that had processionals, recessionals, but they're meeting in a forest because their buildings have been bombed and it's too dangerous to meet in town, so you meet outside in the forest. And this was the way we have church conferences and services in South Sudan, in Murrayland. Many of these pastors have walked so far. Look at this pastor here. His glasses are mostly broken, just balanced on one ear there. He's got his notebook, he's got his pen. He's eager, he's lean, he's walked a long distance. This is a typical moral pastor in Equatorial Sudan, coming to a conference, and he'd walked several days from his village to come there. This is where we'd be bringing communion elements, and for many of them to celebrate communion in the bush, seriously important. Their hymn books were in tatters, they had very little materials. When I asked them, what can we do to help, they said, Bibles, hymn books, prayer books, Sunday school materials. I was asked, do the Christians in the West pray for us? And I had to say, in 1995, I'm sorry, they don't even know you exist, but we're going to change it. And now they're no longer forgotten. They said we are hidden people fighting a forgotten war. But now they can see in the newsletters that we brought back and the books, they've got their pictures are being published. Their stories getting known. Videos are going out. And it means so much to know they're not alone, to know they're not forgotten. It means a lot. Even if we brought them nothing, just the visit, it means everything to them. SPLA, Sudanese People's Liberation Army, were fighting, as they called it, the last war of decolonization in Africa. Here's the bishop's house in the distance and a bomb crater in the foreground. You can see some of the shrapnel. Our vehicle was traveling, and let me tell you, if you're traveling in these sort of areas, you don't want to have the windows up and music on, because then you can't hear the aircraft. Like, we couldn't, and next thing, the vehicle's rocked by an explosion, and then you heard the afterburn of the MiG as the MiG came past, and, well, our vehicle was blown off the road, but not damaged. And fortunately, the ground was very soft. It absorbed the shrapnel a lot on that occasion. That's in the rainy season. In the dry season, the bomb will detonate on the surface, and there's a lot more shrapnel, a lot more damage. So rainy season is actually harder to travel, but safer, because mortars, bombs, and so on are having less impact, because it gets sunk into the ground before it detonates. This was the border post from Kenya into eastern Equatoria, South Sudan. And immediately your prayer life is challenged, because you see bombed out, shot out tanks 12 shot-out vehicles in a 1 kilometer area. Now, hard-skinned vehicles didn't make it. What makes you think your soft-skinned Toyota, Bucky, or Land Cruiser, or Land Rover is going to make it? And this really revolutionized our prayer life, because you really want to know that you're right with God, and you want to know that you're in the center of His will when you're traveling in these kind of roads. So if you want to improve your devotional life, let me recommend, go into a war zone. It will solve all your devotional problems. You will know for sure that you're right with God. We wanted to take an ambulance up there. One of the things we asked, they said an ambulance to get the people wounded at the battlefront, to get them to hospital. And this, we drove all the way up from Transvaal to Sudan and donated it to them. This was the only ambulance for a long time. This is a typical road in South Sudan, and this is a typical bridge. You can see why we need to have these snorkels on the side of our engine, so the engine can breathe. It's also why it's so important for us to have waterproof containers, plasticized packets of Bibles, and then to reseal and reduct tape, because on those bad roads, your waterproof container could have come loose, it could be space. Liquid and literature must never mix. And you can see, I've driven through with the water up to chest height. We'd walk through often, and one person walked through and test. I often would walk through and check before you drove through, because you want to know where's the potholes, where's the big boulders. You don't want to wreck your engine driving through the river. And you can't stop in the middle. If you stop in the middle, you can't restart the engine. That's how you destroy your engine. That's why we have winches to pull oneself out, and that's got to be engaged before you go into the water. It's, we lost a vehicle, got video footage of that, with the person not being ready when he went into the water, when he got stuck and swept away. A lot of bad things can happen in those areas. You can see the Arabic script. The Muslims tried to enforce Arabic on South Sudan, but South Sudan resisted it. They resisted the Arabization. They were meant to go to school on Sunday. They were meant to have Friday as the day off and things like this. Well, Christians resist that from 1956. From the very first day the British left, they resisted Arabization. And the Muslims came to the Equatorial Corps. And the Equatorial Corps was the South Sudanese, mostly Christians, who were meant to be the guardians of the South. And the day the British left, the Arab officers came and said, you hand in your weapons, stand there, get on the train, you're going to the North. And the Equatorial Corps said, we are the guardians of the South. We're not handing in our weapons. We know you're Arabs. You've always treated us as slaves. Yeah. We're not going to hand in our weapons. And that's where the war began. The day the British left, the war began, 1st of January, 1956. Equatorial Corps revolted. They shot the Arab officers, broke into armory, got the rest of the weapons, and that was the beginning of the civil war, which the missionaries had warned the British would happen. They said, you can't make South Sudan part of North Sudan. Make it part of Uganda, Kenya, anything, but don't put black Christians and animists in the same country as Muslim Arabs. But different alphabet, different calendar, different everything. There's nothing in common. It'll never work. And it sure didn't. And so the country's been at war from the day the British left. And the civil war between North and South was huge until 2011, when South Sudan's independence was finally recognized. But that was 2 million people killed later, which, what a terrible loss. Just redrawing the map more intelligently according to ethno-linguistic and cultural religious lines would have saved a lot of lives. Some of the SPLA soldiers we were ministering amongst, their weapons all come from the Arabs. As I said, the enemy is my quartermaster. Everything they had, they captured from the Muslims, which they received from Red China normally, or Indonesia, or Malaysia, in fact, all Muslim countries. And you can see a lot of good Chinese weapons that they loaded up with, and anything they needed. Sometimes the men would say, we need this, that, and the other, and the officer would say, good, it's all available, all the things you need are in a local Arab base. Take the base and you've got all the resupply you need. And that's how they fought their war. And I discovered when I started my work amongst them in 1995, they had no chaplains. They in fact still had commissars, because they'd been trained by Mengistu's communists, Russian-supported characters in Ethiopia. So SPLA was quite a communist revolutionary movement to start with. We had a lot of complaints from local people about the atrocities and so on. So I set to work walking in, chatting, speaking to the people, and persuaded the SPLA leadership that they need to ditch the commissars. Yesterday's ideology, communism is a failure, it's lost, it's finished. Haven't you heard about the Berlin Wall coming down and all that? Communism's day's over. You need to have Christian army, you need chaplains. And they gave me permission to train the first chaplains. We trained the first 70 chaplains, got them up and running. Missionaries built the first bridges during this time. Not a very good bridge, but it worked for a few years. We got Bibles over one side, patients to the hospital across the other. And then one day, 2001, the river swelled to 7 times its normal length and width, and wow, the bridge was washed away. And several people drowned trying to get across. And the only way across was hand over hand, ankle over ankle on the metal fraying cables. And that's when you're glad that you remembered your leather gloves. Yes, I passed pieces of skin and blood of John who went ahead of me. He said, "Rangers, show the way." He didn't have his gloves. And you can see the roads are pretty rough on our tires. This is a typical Sydney's road. Spent a lot of time digging it out of the mud. One time we were stuck and I ended up walking hours through the night, past midnight. We were stuck outside of Yei, and Yei was the capital of the SPLA resistance at that stage. And so I was walking straight down the road and knowing this is dangerous because I'm well known in Moreland, I'm well known in Buriland, I'm well known in Zundiland, but now I'm going into Dinkaland and they don't know me here, I don't know them and I don't know any of their language, and this could be seriously dangerous. We're in an operational area approaching the headquarters of the resistance. There's got to be ambush, roadblock, something. So I'm walking very quietly for hours, and suddenly out of the mist comes a patrol. There's a man, staggered weapon with kit on the other side, they sort of like a Z formation. I'm walking straight down the middle, I saw their eyes widening. I said, "Good evening, good evening, good evening." I walked straight down the middle and their eyes are wide. Nobody replied. Now, I don't know what they were thinking or what they saw, but they disappeared into the dark behind and I kept walking towards the A. I was an operational area and walked straight through a patrol and they didn't challenge me or stop me, and who knows what the angels were doing. But anyway, a little bit later, I heard, I should say I smelled smoke. I walked very quietly and then I heard snoring. I walked softly and I saw the pole across the road, barrels, rocks. There's a sleeping soldier, there's another sleeping soldier, there's a fireplace, more sleeping soldiers. I walked, stepping over the guards, into Yei, past the outer defences, and I was in the headquarters of the SPLA, and nobody had stopped to challenge me. Managed to get the aid to get to our broken down vehicle and our people who were sick there and so on. Next day I borrowed a motorbike and took out what was needed, and we've gone all the way down from planes, boats, vehicles, motorbikes, bicycles, and then on foot, because sometimes you run out of fuel or road. The Jesus film and battery operated, solar panel powered video projectors showing, we've gone in and shown them the Ben-Hur and we've shown them Khartoum. And I remember one person coming to me and saying, "Now it looks like Ben-Hur is Gordon Pasha." I said, "You're very observant. That's Charlton Heston. He's an actor. But actually, you know, Ben-Hur, that's set 1,800 years later before. And this chap got really confused about this, explaining how these are just films of actors." But anyway, most of the people that we ministered to in Sudan and South Sudan said the first film they ever saw was the Jesus film. And to take in the, to get there before Hollywood's always good. And to get there with a good film which is based entirely on the scripture, every word from the scripture. I must have seen the Jesus film over 100 times in maybe 20 languages. I've sat there with my Bible, Good News Bible, comparing, because it's meant to be from the Good News. The Jesus film, every word that Jesus speaks, except one, comes in the Bible. So which is the word they attribute to Jesus in the Jesus film that is not in the Bible? Anyone noticed? Hello. As he comes out of the wilderness being tempted, two kids run up to me, ruffles her hair, one and says, hello. That is definitely not in the Bible. But that's pretty good to have a film where they've gotten every word that they attribute to Jesus comes from the Bible. And that's refreshing. Most of the films you can't say that. In fact, there's a lot of these so-called Bible films today which are so unbiblical. Shocking. We've taken in the first film in the moral language that Jesus fought into the cathedral that's been destroyed three times and rebuilt each time. This man, Canon Reuben, was part of the Equatorial Corps, which in 1956 started the war when the Arabs tried to disarm him. And he still got his old rifle and his old cap from the Equatorial Corps. Most tireless evangelist, hut-to-hut evangelism, really good chap. And although he's the oldest man in the village, he is out there helping to rebuild their church after it was destroyed by the helicopter gunships. So as they're building it, I wanted to encourage the workers. We rigged up a screen, we showed them the film Ben-Hur. And when we finished it, we'd got the timing wrong. It wasn't thatching season, we didn't have thatch, so we had to just put plastic on the roof and wait till the thatch could be harvested in. And it was. And so here's the church, slightly bigger than the previous one, but built in the same location, just one of many examples I could give you of Jesus Christ building his church, and the gates of hell cannot prevail against it. The first chaplains conference in the SPLA, a big event, 1996, and we had these chaplains that we were training in the Bishop Gwynne Bible College, which is also frontline mission base. We organized the first handbook, prayer book, chaplains, materials, brought in the Bibles, gave them everything from boots, backpacks, bicycles, equipped them with what they needed to put wheels under the word. And here's some of the chaplains being sent out to the different units. To get into Sudan, we'd need to charter aircraft. It was very illegal to do what we were doing, flying up these areas. No fly zones. You needed very adventurous pilots who were willing to fly without authorization. This is an old Second World War vintage DC-3. This is a Mitsubishi, very smart thing that Samaritan's Purse was using for bringing in their hospital material. I was asked by the SPLA people and the local church back in 1996, can you not establish the hospital again? We don't have a hospital for 5 million people. I said, well, we're not a medical mission. I mean, a man's got no limitations. But I'll find the right medical mission. Then it came to mind, during the Rwandan Holocaust, 1995, the only mission that was in Rwanda, aside from us, was Samaritan's Purse. Everyone else had left. Red Cross had all fled, but Samaritan's Purse was there. I stayed with them when they were clearing out thousands of corpses, 7,000 corpses out of the Kigali Hospital, to be able to clear out all the body parts and congealed blood in the plumbing systems that you could make this hospital re-operational again, like rats bigger than cats running around, just hideous, the amount of flying, crawling insects. And they were there, so I thought Samaritan's Purse, they're the right people. Let's get Samaritan's Purse involved in the work in Sudan. So I wrote to Franklin Graham and I got a, sorry, too busy, not available, that sort of type of answer from his secretary. And then I contacted, on another occasion, still no possibility. Then I saw Franklin Graham was coming to Cape Town, my home city, where our mission is based, for an evangelistic crusade. The first and only time Franklin Graham's ever done it, as far as I know. So, excellent. I wrote, asked for an appointment when he's in town, no program's full. I'm praying, surely this is the Lord's plan. We've got to be able to meet together. So, then, while I'm praying, in comes the mail, and there's this beautiful index gilt-edged card from the mayor of Cape Town inviting me to a prayer breakfast in City Hall, where the guest speaker is going to be Franklin Graham. So I made sure I was there early and parked my motorbike on the side, walked in with my helmet over my arm, and there's Franklin Graham and the mayor standing at the front. And so I said, Mr. Graham, I believe you're also a motorbike. And his eyes lit up, yes I am. And I said, I believe you've also trained chaplains for the resistance forces in Nicaragua. He said, yes, I did. I was working with the Contras. I said, I've been doing that for the resistance fighters in Angola, Mozambique, and in Sudan. I have one question for you, Mr. Graham. Why is Samaritan's Purse not in Sudan? He said, we were in Sudan. I said, yes, 5 years ago. He said, we found we couldn't work with the people there. And I said, you were working with Riek Machar's crowd. He's a surrogate for the Arabs. No wonder they stole you out blind. Riek Machar's SSIM has been doing more damage to the south than even the Arabs have. I didn't know that, he said. I said, I know the right people. People you can trust. People who won't steal. People who are reliable. And as I started to get him enthused about Moreland and the work of Kenneth Fraser and his hospital, which was lying derelict, needing to be rehabilitated, the perfect place for him to go, people start to arrive, and so he said, I'll have to speak to you later. Well, the long and the short is, 2 days later, Franklin Graham gets the go-ahead. I'm to take in their team. They want to look at the place. And we managed to get them into southern Sudan. But his advanced team of four people he sent with me, they were pretty skeptical, cynical. They'd seen Africa. They weren't impressed with what I was trying to say. And they didn't believe this was a good project. So I was telling them about the work of Kenneth Fraser, the Moro people. And I said, you could leave your wallet lying on the main road by the marketplace and somebody would bring it to you and nothing would be missing. And this chap was just so irritated. I remember Ken Isaac saying to me, do you really believe that rubbish? And I said, yes, the Moro people have been really well discipled by Kenneth Fraser. They don't steal. These people are honest people. So he said, give me a wallet. As I gave him my wallet, he threw it out the window as we were driving out, right by the marketplace, landed in the road. And all of these SP people were laughing as we drove off for the day, as I was going to show them the hospital glory. Now, my heart sank. I started to feel sick. Not, there wasn't much in the wallet, to be honest. There was just, you know, a little bit of money and a few cards. But I felt sick because I thought, what if I've overstated the case? What if there's somebody from another tribe coming past? I mean, so I had a sleepless night when he got back. And the next morning on the way to church, along comes Canon Reuben with two little boys and says, is this your wallet? These boys found it outside the marketplace. And Ken Isaac's face fell with jaw. And I opened it up and there was nothing missing. And at that point, I saw everything change. I said, you know, we're coming here. And they'd said to me, Samaritan's Purse doesn't commit to more than 3 months anyway. We've never been anywhere more than 6 months, but we'll commit to being here for 6 months. Tops. They were there for 10 years. The biggest project ever done by Samaritan's Purse, and they were in their 10 years, they did tens of thousands of operations. They saved a lot of lives. Phenomenal work. So anyway, we managed to fly in sometimes with airplanes and deliver a lot of Bibles. Sometimes we were chartering Africa Inland Mission, Air or Trackmark, other groups, Missionary Aviation Fellowship. This is a Second World War Vintage DC-3 flying in huge amounts of Bibles. And you can take 3 tons in. Tupolev off conversion. This is, by the way, ex-South African Air Force. World War II Vintage. Turboprop conversion, carrying 3 tons of Bibles into Sudan. The largest shipment of Bibles that I am aware of ever smuggled into an officially Islamic country. 9,700 Bibles and New Testaments in 7 languages, landing in an officially Muslim area, newly liberated airstrip. The airstrip had been in the hands of the Arabs until shortly before, and almost all these Bibles and books distributed in newly liberated territory. Like the hymn books, prayer books, catechisms, Bibles. And I told you earlier about the great story of Canon Ezra Lawiri, and this is the first 3,000 Bibles in the Moro language delivered to the church that will not die, distributed throughout southern Sudan. This is just a wonderful example of how the Word of God is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. God's Word will not return void. It'll accomplish everything that the Lord sent out to accomplish. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, but it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. So, this was the church that was bombed. As James Kennedy said, never was an evangelism explosion clinic more appropriately named. And indeed, here's Pastor Moses and Pastor John, myself outside the church. The church was bombed and not destroyed. A 5-hour service. One of the best, most wonderful worship services it ever was my privilege to attend. And what a great group of people to train in EE. So, what I've been showing you is just South Sudan. which is now independent. Now I want to go behind enemy lines to the Nuba Mountains, an island of Christianity and a sea of Islam. 3.5 hours flying time north of the Kenyan border. 18 helicopter gunships between us and the Nuba, who have a shoot on sight policy. Here's MI-2400 helicopter gunship shooting up a front line and Voice of the Martyrs team. We're doing a joint op into the Nuba, and this picture was taken under fire as there was strafing, machine gunning, riddling, and tearing some people to shreds as there were machine gunning a team on arrival in the Nuba. These are some of the victims of that attack. This woman had what was left of her leg amputated without anesthetic. Can you imagine having your leg amputated without anesthetic? The team fled up the mountain, were taken to the protection of the Nuba resistance, the SPLA, and the major holding the topper of in the middle, he said, every one of us will have to die before one of you is harmed. That's taking hospitality to extremes. When we got our team out, I put another team together to fly back in with a bigger aircraft. It's a Lockheed 4-ton carrying capacity, taking 2 tons of arms, 1 ton of agricultural tools and seed, 1 ton of educational materials, including the blackboards. You see this team, 250 people walking up the mountain, carrying 16 blackboards on their heads for the schools we're going to establish. They had less than 15% literacy when we began. Now it's more than 35%. And these people are not paid, they're volunteers. They had to get up at about 2 in the morning, get down the mountain early, walk us up. As we walked to the Nuba, we saw burned out villages, bombed out villages. Tamsit, Komi, draining the sea to catch the fish. Everything necessary to sustain life destroyed. Wells poisoned or dynamited. This man, James Cramer, had what was left of his arm cut off, amputated, without anesthetic. Why? They destroyed his village at Adudu. They killed all his cattle and his goats, chickens. Destroyed his crops, and then just in case he wanted to join the resistance, they chopped his arm off. Why would you want to join the resistance with a government that understanding? I saw something that made my hair curl and hair on the back of my neck stand up. It just didn't look possible. A man without feet. How do you lose both feet? He's an evangelist, they said. The Arabs chopped his feet off. Chopped his feet off? Yes. They axed his feet off at the ankles, both feet. To show the people what happens if you continue to take the gospel to your neighboring tribes. When I saw this man, I took this picture. He was riding on a donkey or walking on his knees. You can see his knees are calloused. He wasn't allowing the inconvenience of not having knees keep him from taking the gospel to his neighbors. I mean, what excuse does that leave you and me with? The young people in the Nuba have been kidnapped, taken to Dar el-Islam's peace camps, where they are given different names. Muhammad, Michael becomes Muhammad, Mary becomes Miriam. You're given Muslim names and you must now learn Arabic. They're beaten if they speak their home language. They've got to speak Arabic. They've got to learn Arabic, or they are refused food, medicine, water, and so on. There's one man who, if he's alive today, has got a crutch and an AK-47. The Arabs came to his village, shot him in the one knee. He's writhing in agony. They dragged him off to their peace camps and they said, curse Christ and we will give you medical care. He refused to curse Christ. They smashed his other knee with their rifle butts. He's writhing in agony in the blazing heat and they said, just recite the creed of Islam, we'll take you into the shade and give you water. He wouldn't do it. They left him in the sun. He escaped that night, pulled himself under barbed wire. He pulled himself all night, hid all day under bush. All night, pulled himself for 3 days until he got to the SPLA resistance controlled parts of the mountains. And the last time I saw him, he was fighting with a crutch, only one leg vaguely good. The mountains have become sanctuaries for the SPLA. They are an island of Christianity. In the sea of Islam, resisting Islam, with weapons that are captured from the enemy. Sometimes the Muslims have put entire divisions into Nuba Mountains. All they've succeeded in doing is resupplying the SPLA with a whole lot of new weapons. You can see the Christian flag flying from some of these little outcrops. on the sides of this rough, scorpion-ridden territory. This is just the southernmost point of the Sahara, this rough territory. These men said, we are not like the southerners who've been resisting the Arabs for just 50 years. We Nubians have been resisting the Muslims for 14 centuries. That's not much of an exaggeration, because for 1,400 years there have always been Christians in Nubian mountains resisting Islam. Extraordinary. The ancient Christian kingdoms of Nubia, Elwand, the Tower in the north, they have fought Islam. But some of the survivors fled to the Nubian mountains, where they continued to resist Islam. An extraordinary people. The Bible says in Isaiah 18 that beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, a tall, smooth-skinned people of strange speech, a banner will be raised in the mountains, a trumpet will sound and you will hear it. Something of worldwide significance, Isaiah 18 says, will take place in Sudan, in the mountains, beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. A banner will be raised in the mountains. When the enemy comes in like a flood, God will raise up a standard to which the righteous will repair. And under the Christian flag, we have preached and taught and evangelized and discipled our Christians in the New Mountains who are fervent. And they said, our grandfathers fought the Muslims. Our fathers fought the Muslims. We fight the Muslims. Our sons are fighting the Muslims. One day our grandsons will fight the Muslims. But we will never bow to Mecca. And that's the kind of tenacity you get there. A people who have escaped from slave caravans that have been en route to Khartoum, and many have escaped up the Nubian Mountains and found sanctuary there. And these are descendants of an ancient people who are determined not to give in to Islam. This little boy, 12 years old, he's carrying a Lee Enfield bolt-action rifle. He's got a dangerous job. He's the goat herder. And he could be captured by slave traders. He's entrusted with the food supply of the village. And he's got to come off the mountain, down onto the valley, which is quite dangerous, to get some grazing. And so he's got to be able to defend himself at 12 years old. Some of these places are a bit like Platteklif Gorge and so on in Cape Town, except without the nicer climate, it's a lot hotter. And here you can see a 15-year-old girl walking in front carrying 35 kilograms of the Jesus film projector. That was when we were still using 16mm projector. And about four people behind you see another 15-year-old also barefoot, and she's carrying the generator, 30 kilograms of metal. I asked the men, why don't you carry it? It's too heavy for us, the girls must carry that. In fact, the women carry all the heavy weights over there, and you can see every bit of water you need for washing, cooking, cleaning. It's all got to be brought from the valley down below. There's not enough water on top of the mountain in the dry season. And the women carry everything and the men carry next to nothing. I mean, chivalry has not arrived in the Nubian Mountains. And you can see why we take in these 20-liter plastic containers with the lids, because you could drop it and it won't spill. But the calabash, you could just stumble a bit and you lose a lot of the water. You can think, you've got to walk sometimes for hours carrying that water. Makes you think. We learn to wash our hair and everything with 2.5 cups of water. You can be very judicious when you've got to carry it. And the women carry a lot. The men don't carry much at all. Do you know that the majority of girls and women in Africa spend most of their day fetching water, making fires, and fetching wood? The amount of time we save with electricity and plumbing, it's extraordinary. I mean, if you just think of the amount of time every day we're saving just with plumbing and electricity. And you may think that's a grandmother. It isn't. I mean, these people age young because it's a harsh environment there. And when I go there, they always, oh, you must give us your backpack. And I say, I can't give you my backpack. No, you must give us your backpack. This is our culture. You've got to respect our culture. You shame us before the villagers, because if they see you carrying it, they'll think that we're not doing our job. We're not being hospitable. You must give us your backpack. Give us your backpack. So I can't give you my backpack. If I give you my backpack, you'll give it to some teenage girl, and that'll be a great disgrace to me. In my culture, the men carry the heavy weights. No, no, you don't understand. They'd say, that's why God made the girls, to carry the heavy weights. It's shocking, but we have not relented on this. This is a point that I will die over, but I mean, they're not getting my backpack. Simple, we carry our own weight. Some of the villages we've been to, they are Coptic Christians. Dates from a long way back. And they used to have a beautiful wooden church down in the valley, but that's been destroyed. Now they've got a little thatch church at 4,500 feet elevation. It gets cold at night on Nuba because their church has been destroyed by the Arabs down below. Many Muslims have come to Christ in Nuba Mountains. We take the metal hose. We saw that the woman would be running in a bombing to pick up the shrapnel. Hot, sharp shrapnel, burning the hands and cutting the hands. Why are you risking your life for a piece of metal? I say, the valley was very fertile, but up here it's hard to till the soil. We don't have any metal. And it's hard to do work with wooden tools. And so the women get up early during a bombing to get the metal tool, the metal shrapnel, because it'll be gone too quickly. We thought, if they risk their lives for a bit of metal, we can fly that in. So you can see we've taken machetes, hose, spades, but we don't bother to take in the wooden part because they can affix that in Nuba. Weight is valuable when you've got to pay for every kilogram on a chartered aircraft. The hunger for literature is intense. And you can see the enthusiasm. And even if a person gets a tract and he can't read, he'll find someone who can read to read to him. And it's so important that they know they're not alone, they're not forgotten. So how do we distribute our books there? Faith Under Fire Sudan book, they all want that. I said, this costs $10 in America, it costs 10 commandments in Sudan. You tell me the 10 commandments in English, it's an English book, I'll give you the book. And interesting, because you can always tell who the Catholics are. The Catholics, they've taken out the second commandment, not to bow before idols, and they've made the 10th commandment, 9 and 6, do not covet your neighbor's wife, number 9, number 10, do not covet your neighbor's goods. So I let a Catholic finish and then say, are you Catholic? He says, yes. And I say, well, I'll give you the book because you've given the Ten Commandments correctly as your church teaches it, but you are aware that your church has left out the second commandment. Why? Why would they do that? Well, maybe because of statues, Mary, crucifixes, idols. And they're shocked. I've had a lot of Catholics come to Christ just by that explanation of pointing out about the second commandment. Hymn books, catechisms, The Man in the Box Who Speaks My Language. Audiovisual. Boy, the people love this. This is gospel recordings at its best. Although this old technology now we're using the solar paneled type mega voice. But the flip charts, 9 hours Bible teaching tapes from Genesis through the book of Acts. And they will have a crowd wherever they go. Very effective. And this is not a media saturated site. These people love the Bible teaching. And you can get a crowd in the marketplace. We've equipped hundreds of evangelists and Sunday school teachers across Sudan and other parts of Africa with these. And you can see some fun. This is the new gospel recordings equipment, backpacks, bike, sending them out, mega voice, audiovisual, the whole Bible digitally available with the solar panel powered. Traveling from village to village, we have to be very careful because they've put death threats out, they've put a price on our heads. The governor of Sudan's main Ministry of Foreign Affairs website has a death threat against me and says, Peter Hammond should expect to be shot on sight. He should expect to be bombed every time he comes to Sudan because his writings make him an enemy of the state. So that's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs letting everyone know they don't bomb Christians in Sudan, but they'll make an exception in my case. So we are very careful going from one side to the other, and we've got to not stay anywhere for too long because somebody might get greedy and try to communicate. And we have had Arabs sending in hit teams to try and get us, and we've had to run all day on occasion. On this occasion, I was a little foolish. I was thinking like a Westerner. We got to Oasis crossing, we had to walk from one side of the Nuba Mountains to the other, so we left at about 2 in the morning to cross the big open plain controlled by the Arabs. We walked about 70 kilometers in one day, and according to our GPS, and that was a 12-hour stretch hike. So at one point we were stopping at an oasis, and I left my machine gun out with escort and said, wait here, I'm just going to witness in the marketplace. In minutes of witnessing, Muslims went hysterical, shots were fired, and they were trying to kill me, and in came my escorts who hitting people in the face with rifle butts, surrounded me, pulled me out. It was quite a dramatic, chaotic piece of nonsense. Since then, I've always carried an AK-47 around my shoulders when witnessing in the marketplace, and I've never had a problem since. So basically, an armed society is a polite society. If you If you think that pessimism is going to help you in the Muslim world, I've had a different experience. This is a typical old school Jesus film evangelism kit. 70 kilograms of fuel, kit, projector, and so on. However, you can see these people on the outdoor walking, not a driver, it's a walk-in, and you can see the 16mm projector bounced on the rocks, and showing the people the first film they've ever seen. The old 16mm projectors, I liked it in some ways, awkward though it was, because you've got four preaching opportunities, five actually, intro, between each reel, while the team was rewinding, and then the end. And sometimes we had people following us from village to village to memorize the film. Could give a story about us being chased, false information, sent the wrong landing strip by shortwave radio, and we had to run all day with our escorts as they were after us. This man, we flew out every time we tried to fly people who were injured. This man lost his foot to a landmine. Take him out to get the prosthetic foot. So our mission did something quite unusual. We then brought in anti-landmine equipment. That's landmine detecting top-class stuff from Germany, the best. That even can detect the plastic mines with just the metal firing pin. Very, very precise. We brought in South African engineers who'd spent 12 years lifting landmines. We could train them, and that was worthwhile. This is rare. Two aircraft on the airstrip at the same time. We chartered both. We'd actually chartered a DC-3, but weren't able to provide it to the Sentinel 2 because we had a pretty big team and a lot of things we were doing. And that was one of the teams that filmed the Saddam Hidden Holocaust, so that's why you can see a film of another plane flying in. That's kind of rare. Can you see this aircraft crashed behind us? The one you saw me flying on the first time crashed on another mission in there, and food that we're donating to the people. This is the Lockheed you saw us fly in on an earlier time. We were not the people charging it when it crashed, but this has become a permanent feature. It's not going anywhere. Bible College, where they don't have a building. This is in Kauda, which is the capital of the Free Nuba, but they get bombed a lot. The Bible College will go wherever we are, and they might walk 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 kilometers to get a week of lectures when we get there. This church at Kauda had been bombed many a time, many times. We went there to encourage them, but the church was full, packed to overflowing. They weren't going to let 18 air raids keep them from gathering in church. On this occasion, we had another place, same Bible college, but they were clever. Even though they'd walked from the other side of Nuba, they said, Peter will surely bring us Bibles. So they brought the woman from the village to carry the Bibles back. Yeah, and now you can see the difference between a rainy season and a dry season. They got excited over the Bibles and hymn books and catechisms, or Toro, Haiban, Trongo, and that's quite a story. Because at the Gakawi conference in 1997 in Pretoria, I was in the missions mobilizers groups, the missions execs, and we were meeting at the Baptist Church down in Pretoria, just opposite where the American embassy is, and George Verbo was running it, and he's like, Trongo, under the people group. Nuba, Peter Hammond, you work in the Nuba. You take the Krongo. He gave me the Krongo file. Right, so next time I get to Nuba Mountains, I said, I need to find the Krongo unreached people group. Yes, Pastor so-and-so and Evangelist so-and-so. No, the unreached people group, the Krongo. Yes, Pastor so-and-so and Evangelist so-and-so. They're meant to be unreached. No, 70% of Christians. What? So it seems the Holy Spirit does not provide full reports to the U.S. Center for World Missions and the Unreached People Group. He's doing a lot more than we're aware of. And I've found this time and again, I've had to report back to Patrick Johnson that, you know that Unreached People's Group, the Lomwe in Mozambique, my first mission, 1982, I discovered there were 600 Baptist churches amongst the Lomwe. They had been listed as an Unreached People Group in the 1980 or 76 edition of Opworld. So amazing how these things change. So I then found out that there was a Krongo New Testament translated by an Australian missionary team back in the 50s and 60s. And here's a typewriter, duck, 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 old typewriter, before electricity and all this. Yeah? So we scanned this, we didn't dare typeset it or scan it, because who can proofread Kroger? That missionary generation is gone. So we took it in. This is 1962, all the missionaries are kicked out of Sudan, and they're just about to finish the Kroger New Testament. So these missionaries hadn't been able to take it back in, so we took it in, got it printed, and this is a very unusual type of shape. It's more like a B4, not before A4 size. So it's a typewriter size. We took in these Bibles, and absolutely tremendous. Here you can see Krongo evangelists, pastor evangelists, were the first Krongo New Testaments in their language, translated 50 years before. We reap where others sowed, with tears. And what a privilege. And those missionaries couldn't have known. They said when they left, there were only 5 Christians amongst the Krongo. We came back 70% for evangelicals. So I could give you many stories like that, but let me stop at this point on serving the persecuted. Are there any questions or comments at all? It's just so humbling when you realize what some people sacrificed a lifetime for, and we get the privilege of delivering these, which other people really worked hard for.
Dr. Hammond, if you could just be, maybe make yourself a little bit vulnerable for a second, but just some of the things that you're struggling with out there in the field on a personal level, would you be willing to share with us, just, as a Christian brother in the faith, just to encourage some of us that are actually going through some stuff as well?
Yes, well, obviously, amongst the things we struggle with, there's strong temptations to bitterness, anger, unforgiveness, rage. I mean, we see atrocities. So how does one handle seeing such horrible injustice and cruelty being perpetrated by human beings? I found praying the Psalms is very, very, very important. The Psalms are so full of honesty. It's the middle book of the Bible. It's the prayer book of the Bible. It's the hymn book of the Bible. David wrote most of the Psalms that describes a man after God's own heart. And in the Psalms you get frustration, anger. You get bitterness, you get rage, you get joy, you get everything. But he takes it to God. And he puts it at the foot of the throne of God, and he leaves it with God. And so I found praying the Psalms very important. There's sometimes I didn't want to pray, I didn't know how to pray, I was too angry to pray. I turned to the Psalms. I mean, you open up the Bible in the middle, and you start to pray the Psalms. How did he know? How did they get? This is exactly echoing what's going on in my heart and mind. The turmoil, it's all there in the Psalms. And to pray the Psalms, the amount of times the Psalms have lifted me out of anger and depression and distraction, misdirection and all that. So that's key. The other thing is to do something about it. Because I think my first experience is Mozambique was my first mission field back in the 80s. And I realized that I had to do something. I mean, when you've seen all that, I had to speak up for them. So I had to publish, speak out. I had to document it. I remember coming back in a Transvaal, I speak in Randburg, in fact, at a church here, Baptist Church, and somebody came to me after and said, I've just been giving a report back to Mozambique. He said, what you've got to say is very hard to believe. Next time, take pictures. And that's just good advice, actually. I can't remember who it was. I don't know his name, but it was like a directive from the Lord. And that's why I started to get the slides, overheads, and now you can see PowerPoints. Because it's one thing for me to say Muslims are bombing churches in Sudan. Well, maybe. But if I show the pictures of it, more convincing. So it was so much of a help that. So I knew I have got to help the people, I've got to speak up for them, and then there were things I could do. Bringing them things that could help them, which they always said the Bible's the first thing, Bible teaching's the second, medical was also important. And so we basically got our agenda from them. If I did nothing, I'm sure we would have gotten into depression. But we followed up. And to make a difference, I think that helps one to live with it too. So definitely the Psalms, praying imprecatory Psalms. Have you noticed how many of the Psalms are praying against evil? Praying for justice, praying for, not for us to take the law into our own hands, praying for God to intervene. And so these imprecatory prayers, these appeals to God to intervene and to bring justice in a situation, that's helped a lot. So, yes, that's part of it. Same would go with the fear, praying the Psalms, the concerns. There's so many things. I would say one of our concerns of all of our missionaries is we can't compare our spiritual and devotional life back here at home within the field. It doesn't matter what one tries, you're at a greater edge and you're closer to the Lord in the field in this dangerous, difficult situation. And we all have this feeling of like, it's like you've backslidden when you've come back. There's something about our environment that makes it spiritually unhealthy, or it's harder to be a Christian in Johannesburg than it is to be a Christian in the Congo or Sudan. I mean, that's my personal experience. I've had better times of fellowship, devotions, worship, prayer in Mozambique, in prison, under fire, in Sudan, even Eastern Europe in the old days, than anywhere in the West. And what does that say about our programs? There's nothing like putting feet to your faith and getting into the mission field to really, you know. So, any other questions or comments?
My walking partner commented about Jose Hegel's, she's a Muslim, first time being there, and how wonderful it was that she's thrown a lovely party for orphans, you know, Muslim orphans. And I'm trying to tell her that, you know, there's the money goes for tourism, which is just the best way to talk about this, what it takes the next.
There's no doubt that a lot of these Muslim charities are actually helping train suicide bombers and support the Intifada and all that. It's quite distressing. Yes. It's been well documented too. Any other questions or comments? By the way, this is a picture here of the president of South Sudan. He wasn't president at that time. This is the commander of the SPLA, who now is the president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir in the middle. Bishop Bulanduli, this is the governor of Equatoria. Kenneth Baringo, the man who gave us the Macedonian call. Back in 1995, when the Rwandan Holocaust had just subsided, I was in Rwanda and this man tracked me down. Kenneth Bringer, he had heard about our work in Mozambique and Angola, and he came and he took hold of me by the shoulders and said, "You must come to Moreland." It's like a Macedonian call. And plainly God worked through it. It was God's call. You could see it was retrospective. But it was quite a shock. And I had all the leaders of missions in Nairobi saying, "You can't do it. It can't be done. Too dangerous." The head of Sudan Interior Mission told me it's impossible to work in Sudan back in 95. But he said I had to come, and we took him as his word, and God put a seal over it. So today, this man is the president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir. Any other questions or comments?
I'm sorry, I can't express my question accurately. I know this is related to sort of you're mixing not just sharing the gospel, but very practical Christian living. The times you've been taking up arms, the pacifism doesn't work. And I think that possibly flies in the face of how a lot of people, can I say, would feel comfortable approaching the past or feel comfortable talking about it. And it seems like you've had success with the way that you have approached it. So what is your opinion on separating, if I
can almost call it that, ministry, and these realities, what people are dealing with, because all around you have taken landmines that you didn't, because maybe comments and look at all that from the next. Well, I must admit, God had to deal with me on the landmine clearing equipment, because when the local people asked me to bring in landmine clearing equipment, fear sprung up in my mind, and it was a disgusting fear, because it was a fear of what people would say. And I had this thought of, our mission is going to get criticized, we're going to be accused of getting involved in the war. You know, it's one thing taking Bibles and medical kits and training chaplains and medics, but landmine clearing equipment, this is another thing. But I saw the people and had to fly the people out who had lost their feet. who'd been crippled. I only showed you one picture, there's a lot of others, some of them very distressing. And they plant the landmines. The Muslims have planted landmines close to water points where little girls were going to fetch the water. They're planting it on the paths leading to churches and marketplaces. It's disgusting. People who go to harvest crops, sometimes a grandmother would detonate landmine. They'd planted mines amongst the crops. So I looked at this and I thought, shame on you, Peter Hammond, that you hesitate for a moment to take landmine clearing equipment in there just because of what people will say. If this was your daughter who is at risk of the landmine, you wouldn't hesitate. And so I had to surrender on this because I believe that God convicted me of the need to take in landmine clearing equipment. And yes, we have been criticized, of course. But my father fought in the Second World War all 6 years in the 8th Army, North Africa and Italy. My grandfather's fought. There were 480 Hammonds who died in the First World War alone, according to Commonwealth War Graves Commission. My brother was in the Rhodesian Light Infantry. I was in the South African Infantry, 6th South African Infantry. So our military, I was brought up in Rhodesia. Our teachers carried machine guns. We were brought up where rifles were propped up by the door and over the mantelpiece in the farm. And a bullet was in the chamber. It wasn't just a show thing. You're ready. And we went to the roads endangered by landmines. And the teachers carried machine guns. And we had to be alert. You never switch on the light without first closing the curtains. You didn't open the door without switching off the light. You never frame yourself because of reality of terrorism. So I'm perhaps more comfortable with this than a person who wasn't brought up in a war situation like we were in Rhodesia. But it's also my Bible study, because when I was converted in 1977, I immediately imbibed pacifism, because I thought to be a Christian you have to be a pacifist. And in fact, when I went in the army, I went in as a pacifist, believe it or not. And I fought a lot of battles over that, so to speak, and I got beaten up quite a lot for being a pacifist, a traitor in some people's minds. But I had no problem doing the training. I just said, but I'm not going to use it in action. So I did the military training, shooting range, got the shooting medal, the whole lot, which they found hilarious, local pacifist. But then through Bible study, I was convinced that I was wrong. It was quite embarrassing after winning this. So everyone accepted me as the pacifist. Suddenly, now I go to the sergeant major and say, I want to be reassigned for combat duty because I believe I've been wrong. David was a soldier. Barak, Samson, Gideon. So much of the Psalms is written by soldiers. The Bible is not a pacifist book. And God isn't a pacifist. And when the Lord returns, there's going to be a lot of armies of Antichrist wiped out. And the Lord is no pacifist. So I came to the conclusion that I was wrong, and that my pacifism was actually humanism, and I'd misunderstood the holiness of God and the depravity of man. I was thinking man is too good, people are too good, nobody deserves to be killed. Well, actually, when you realize we all deserve it, and it's only the grace of God that makes a difference, it changes things. And also the practicality, when I saw what was going on in Avambaland, Angola, and so on, of course that had to change my way of thinking. So I have no problem with a Christian being involved in military, just like John the Baptist didn't have a problem, or the Lord Jesus. When the soldiers came to John the Baptist, what must we do? He said, don't take money from anyone by force. Don't accuse them of falsehood. Be content to be paid. So he told them how to be good soldiers. He didn't say lead the army. Jesus never suggested that to be a soldier was in and of itself wrong. In fact, he praised a Roman centurion of having greater faith than any in Israel. And the centurions in the Gospels and in Acts are all referred to pretty positively. In fact, Cornelius' household in Acts 10, they're the first Gentiles to receive the full blessings of Pentecost, which is extraordinary. And the Apostle Peter testifies at the Jerusalem Church Council that how could we deny them, which when the Holy Spirit had accepted them, then how could we not? So, as I was going through my Bible study group in the army, I came to the conclusion that my pacifism was unbiblical. And as a missionary, of course, I've got to be very careful, but as a mission of people who grew out of the army, our mission grew out of a daily Bible study and prayer fellowship in the army. So a lot of our people initially were ex-Rhodesian, ex-South African military, and we obviously were very comfortable being missionaries to soldiers and starting chaplain services and training the chaplains and the medics. Now, some missions would find that terrible, and I know. I've heard when I've been to Parliament to give submissions, we've had the Southern Communist Party people say, "Frontline fellowships, the armed wing of the ACEP." And they'll make those sort of comments. We know them in Parliament. In fact, there's several of these people, Ronnie Kestrels and so on, who've made comments about frontline Christians are dangerous. They're the militant Christians. Well, not that militant. We've never advocated violence. We've had our protests. We don't break a bottle. There's no litter left behind. We don't damage anything. The first time we marched to Parliament over their legalization portion, they had armored cars, riot squad. We thought, what are they doing when we're walking up and giving them tracks in their armored cars? They didn't bother to turn up in that any other time since. So we realized, oh, these aren't the people who riot. When we march and protest, we protest. What they call protesters are actually rioters. You damage property, you're not a protester. You're a rioter. So we're not militant because we don't disrespect anyone's property. And we behave ourselves to a large extent according to rules. But when it comes to Bible smuggling, we'll do that because no government has the right to countermand the Great Commission of our Lord Jesus Christ. So the Lord says go into all the world. He doesn't say stop at the barbed wire fence, the iron curtain, the border, the minefield. So we keep going. And as a Christian, I've got no problem to have weapons, to use weapons, because of the need to defend. For example, you just take in Exodus 22, if a thief breaks into the house at night and he is struck so that he dies, there is no guilt for his bloodshed. That's a thief. I'm not talking about a murderer, terrorist, rapist, for child abuse and pedophile. Just a thief at night. You strike him in the dark, maybe it's excessive force, but it was dark. You didn't know. You couldn't tell if it was murder or whatever. So there's no guilt for even killing a thief at night. But how much more right is it to kill a terrorist bursting into church? For example, St. James Church of England, 25th of July, 1993. Five Pan-African Congress terrorists burst into St. James Church of England in Cape Town, machine gun the congregation, hurt the head raised. One of our missionaries, Charlton Baker, happened to be there, stuck with a 38 revolver at the back of the church, fired from about 50 meters, hit the terrorist at the front, wounded him, caused him to break off the attack. The attack was stopped after about 7 or 8 seconds. Imagine how many people would have been killed if it had continued unabated for a couple of minutes, and they'd been able to throw all their grenades, and all five terrorists had brought their weapons together. In fact, only one terrorist opened fire, didn't finish his clip of ammo, two grenades were thrown, 11 people killed, 55 injured, and that's just in the 6-7 seconds it took the Shah to realize this wasn't a sketch being organized by the local youth group. He said when he saw a piece of somebody's skull with hair attached flying through the air with some splinters, he knew this was not a sketch from the church. And that's when he drew his revolver, knelt down, and fired first on the pew in front and took out this terrorist at 50 meters, which is gun control. Gun control is hitting the target. And that's the right thing to do. People criticize Shaul, why did he do this? Isn't this bad? What about loving enemies? And he responded, as we have thought, to love your enemies is to take the gospel to your enemies, which is what he did. After the terrorist attack, and after he testified in court, and they got them in prison because they take the blood samples, the DNA, he took the Bible to them, he prayed with them in prison, he visited their families, and exercise love towards his enemies. But he also had an obligation to love his parents, whose church it was. He had an obligation to love his brothers and sisters in the church. He had an obligation to love his neighbors and love God. We can't make love for enemies overrule love for everyone else. And his first priority was love for God and neighbors. There's no call in the Bible, by the way, to love God's enemies. You must love your enemies. But does anyone here love Satan? Why not? Of course you don't love everybody. So, plainly, as Christians, we mustn't forget our priorities. Love God, love our neighbor. 1 Timothy 5:8. If any man does make provisions for the members of his own household, he is denying the faith. And he's worse than infidel. If you provide for your family education, housing, clothing, love, discipleship. But you don't provide protection. What good is it? You've got to provide protection too. If you don't provide protection, you're worse than an animal. I don't know a single animal that will not fight to protect its young. And these Christians I've spoken to said they wouldn't defend their wife even if they'd been raped and just pray for them. You know, honestly, I've told the wife, you know, you should get another husband, so should he. You know, really, what a pathetic, disgusting thing that you can have a Christian man failing to defend his own. Every animal I know will defend their own. And so, God has given all of his creatures weapons, either flight or fight, camouflage and so on, speed, but many of the animals have horns, teeth, fangs, stings, and so on, claws, talons, beaks. So all of God's creatures have weapons. But not Bible-believing Christians, they've got to be born as. Where does that come from? It's not in keeping with the laws of God or the laws of nature. God has shown us that it's right to fight to defend our own. And so I believe every church should have a security ministry. And we've been training churches in Nigeria, for example, and Sudan, and Kenya, and Tanzania. Security ministry, because churches are a target. When 1,000 churches are targeted in 5 years in northern Nigeria alone, when churches in Kenya are even targeted, then how can any church not have a security ministry? We've got to think security. So, any other comments or questions? I wish we had some to spare, but of course in this country, AK is only for criminals. We are limited to single shots. But then, you know, one of our missionaries, Anthony Hogan, who's one of our missionaries, died in the service of Christ in 1994. When he was a game ranger, he would regularly get into gunfights with the poachers. He had an anti-poaching unit. He had a bolt-action rifle. They had AK-47s. They always outnumbered him. He always won. I know a lot of folks in Kruger National Park fighting poachers. They're using bolt-action rifles. The terrorists or the poachers are using AKs and so on. And the game rangers win. You know, it's not the type of weaponry. It's the skill of the people having it. With my bolt-action rifle with scope on, I'm very happy to go up against any of them with the AKs because I know they're in range of me before I'm in range of them.
It's interesting, I know the crime in South Africa with guns is always a problem in court cases, you know, now you have shot the enemy. So now, what actually happened to that guy in Cape Town when you shot the terrorist? Did he all got free?
Yes, he got the award from... Charlton Baker got an award from the police commissioner in charge of Western Cape for his brave, prompt action which saved countless lives. They never took his firearm into custody, they didn't need to take ballistics from it, there's no, the police just congratulate him. Mind you, it depends what policeman you get. You can get a really top-class policeman who says, like my brother had a home invasion at McLuhan, where 5 men burst through the gates and white woman and men in the guard with guns. My brother retrieved his firearm from his bedside as he came out into the hallway. There was a man standing with a silver automatic pointed gun in his face, not even 2 meters away from him, and opened fire and fired 5 shots at my brother and missed every shot. My brother had to cock his firearm under fire. He didn't have a rounding chamber. Fortunately, he's R-aligned, so he could do this, but most people would not be able to chamber around under fire. He did, without jamming, fired 3 shots back, hit the chap in the stomach and chest. The assailant staggered out. His wife and daughter had done what they'd been trained to do, went to a safe room, got on the floor, phoned for help, all that sort of thing, locked the door and so on. And when my brother went outside, he fired at the rest of them. They all got in the vehicle and fled, taking, fortunately, the dying body of the leader with him. So this chap at least died off property. He wouldn't have survived the shot to the stomach and the chest. When the police came, the police congratulated my brother. I showed him pictures, and he said, yes, that's them. They knew this group. They specialized in home invasions, rape, and murder. They'd wiped out a whole family just a week before. And in the Randburg area, And so, on that occasion, the police just gave him, you know, well done, outstanding, I wish more people did that. So again, it depends on police you get. You could get a sympathetic, positive one, but again, the principle is better to be tried by 12 than carried by 6. Better to defend your actions in a court than to have lost the opportunity to carry on your ministry for as long as God's given you on this earth. So, you know, it's better for us to be ready to defend ourselves. And most rational people should see that it's right to defend against an attack. We must be cowboys, but there's nothing wrong with judicious, minimal force as needed in order to get rid of a clear and present danger.
Peter, just two things. Is it true that those terrorists in the church got their weapons and ammunition from Muslims? That's the one thing. And the second thing is it also true that part of your Great Commission training is that you train people to use arms?
That's correct. On both counts, yes. The Pan-African Congress upper terrorists to attack St. James Church in 1993 were trained by Gaddafi's Libya. They were armed and equipped with weapons. Well, they got their training by the Muslims first, but it looked like the weaponry they used in the attack on St. James came from the Transcar Defence Force under Bonta Holomisa, because they were R4s and so on. They'd gotten weapons, even South African grenades, through Transcar Defence Force. So that was a bit of a disgusting extra thing. So there's a Muslim angle, but there's also treachery within general South Africa. But at our training camps, we teach the people unarmed combat, how to disarm people with knives and guns. We teach them archery, both with Indian bow, recurve bow, and crossbows. We take them through rifles, shotgun, pistols, air rifles. So they get a range of weaponry training, which is useful because if you're going to work in war-torn areas, you've got to know how it works anyway. And sometimes there have been situations where a person has heard the plain click of the person's magazines out and he's about to reload, and you know you've got a moment. And there have been cases where a person is unarmed, knew how weapons worked, were able to disarm the person while he's changing magazines, reloading, and so on. And so that can help. We've been in the field where ambushes have taken place. I remember our escort, both the Mozambique incident, jamming and not able to clear his jam, and getting out of the ditch, going over and helping this chap to clear the jam, that he could get on with this job of protecting us. Our people frequently have known our weapons better than the people we're dealing with and have been ministering amongst them. In Sudan, we've gotten to several cases where they brought us to a base that they took over from the Arabs and said, do you know what goes with which? Because the Arabs, before they fled, they just stripped down and they threw their slides, bolts, different mechanisms all over the place. And in came the SPO and think, this looks great, but what goes with which and how do you make this work? And most of our missionaries could put all together, and this is the Browning, and these go with SKSs, and this is Tokarovs and Makarovs and SKSs and RPGs, PKMs and whatever. We know our weapons, and we are able to. Now you can imagine after that, you stand up to preach in the chaplain's period, you've got their attention, they know, you know their job better than they do, and we've won thousands of SPLA soldiers to Christ. I mean, there's no doubt that when you know your work, and they see that, and you're willing to take the risk and they listen to you. So, whether with UNITA in Angola or Renam in Mozambique or SPLA today, they know we're on their side, and we understand, and we know how it works. I remember going into Nuke Mountain, and the governor saying, I can't get you into Nuke Mountain if you're not willing to be armed and able to defend yourself. I said, Governor, you give me an AK, I'll defend myself, I'll do my part. And he said, well, in that case, I'll let you go, because we can't have people who are unarmed there, because you'd be a burden. You've got to pull your weight. And I wouldn't have even been able to go to Nuke if we weren't willing to carry our share and do our part. Now, I'm not going to go out of my way to attack any Arabs, but if we've got to defend ourselves, we've got to defend ourselves. You know, we want to win Arabs to Christ, and we do. We preach to Muslims who were captured by the SPLA in their prison camps, and we've shared the gospel, we've shown them Jesus for them, we've given them Bibles. Sometimes we've had a riot, actually. Some of these Muslims have wanted to, you know, rip our throats out. So the fact that we were able to defend ourselves and all that is very important. Christians used to be known as the best in art, music, architecture, and fighting. The Crusaders, King David. We shouldn't be known as doormats and wimps. If the salt loses its saltiness, it's good for nothing but to be thrown outside and trampled underfoot. So we've got to have this attitude of being able to and willing to fight and defend against us. I've been in the streets of Hillbrow, and I've been in the streets of Durban, and in Cape Town, and I've seen people attacked. And we had to rescue people. There was a girl that had been trafficked, came across in Hillbrow, Sandy. She'd come from Zimbabwe, she was horribly abused, and I saw being abused in Hillbrow, I stepped in and rescued her from the people abusing her. And, you know, you've got to know how to do that. And so, in our missionary training programs, we teach our people how to defend themselves, because we send them on the streets, we send them to the Malay Quarter, they're doing door-to-door, they're doing outreaches. Anybody can try and attack them, and our men must now defend our women, but if there's no good men around, then the women have got to know how to defend themselves too. So, my children, my two girls as well, they've learned all the martial arts, going from kickboxing all the way through to air rifles, archery, shotguns, pistols, works, and how to do unarmed combat. And I would never leave my children with a babysitter who wasn't skilled and capable in firearms. But maybe I'm being a bit extreme because I'm a missionary who works in war zones and I've got death threats against me. So our mission is like a fortress and our home is even more so. So we think like that because I'm willing to risk my life in the field, but I'm not willing to risk my family's life. So anyway, if that seems a bit shocking to some of you, that's just where we are. And personally, I find that it tallies up with church history more. Pacifism is historically being condemned by the church. The church, the mainstream church, to all ages, has opposed pacifism as an aberration. It's not standard Christianity. I think we should always respect pastors if they've got a conscientious objector. I think we should provide them with alternatives, let them be medics or whatever they want. And if a Jehovah's Witness doesn't want to wear a uniform and he wants alternative service, I take him to alternative service. I don't believe we should force them. And even the Bible, we're told that if someone was afraid and didn't want to be in the army, let them go home. You know, why force them? So I don't agree with this compulsory to the point that a conscientious objector can't be. I think they're wrong, but I think we should respect and protect the right to be pastors. So I'm not militant in that sense. But as an ex-pacifist, I'm probably a bit more strong conviction about it than a person who never imagined pacifism. I'm angry that I wasted a couple of my years being deceived by pacifism. Just like you might meet a person who's come out of drugs, he's more hardcore, a person who wasn't a drunkard, and now he's temperate and teetotaler. I feel the same way. I feel like pacifism was a false religion. But I'd always respect a conscientious objector if he's consistent.